This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
It is 3:26 on Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. The Royals win again yesterday in Danny Duffy's return after about a month on the DL. He was expected to be out anywhere from a month and a half to 2 months, and he came back in, what, just over 5 weeks, so a nice return for him. The Royals now three games over 500, and the tone of what this team's doing this year and where they're heading, not only over the next month or so, but into the rest of the season, has shifted quite a bit over the last month, 2 months of the year. As we welcome on David Leske of Baseball Prospectus Kansas City. Seems like each week you come on, David, we're rehashing old conversations, and now I wonder if we look back and wonder if we were a little silly a month ago, a month and a half ago, saying that this team was destined to be sellers at the trade deadline.
I don't think we were silly. I mean, they were, what, 21 and 29 on Memorial Day? I don't think we were wrong to not expect what happened or what has happened, especially with Danny Duffy being injured and out for all but one game since Memorial Day, and that was yesterday. So, I mean, I'm glad we were wrong, but I don't think we were silly to think that. And I think that the Royals have just gone on a crazy run that would have been incredibly difficult for anybody, but apparently Dayton Moore and Ned Yost to predict.
Well, it's funny. I remember right when Duffy went on the DL, we talked about it. And I think you kind of brought up the point that having him on the DL may actually have an adverse effect on this team if you think they should be sellers, because people are going to say, hey, just wait for Duffy to get back, and they're going to be even better than they have been over the past 5 weeks. But now we're sitting here, and I think it's a realistic thing to expect. So I wonder if we just have Stockholm syndrome, or if no, actually the tides have turned, and there is a lot of reason for optimism with Duffy back.
Well, I think there is reason for optimism at this point. When we talked about that, it's true. I thought, okay, you know what? If they can find a way to hang around, which they're not going to do, then when Duffy comes back, we can make these sweeping generalizations that he will make the Royals a playoff team and blah 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 blah. I thought there was no way, and you know what, that they would be able to hang around. I thought, okay, if he can come back at the All-Star break and they're, I don't know, 40 and 47 or something like that, then maybe the Royals would try to sell us that Duffy's back, we can make up those games. Well, at this point, the worst they're going to be heading into the All-Star break is 43 and 44 with Duffy back. And if they win one game, there'll be a game over 500 at the All-Star break, which is crazy to think about considering the way they started. So, you know, I think that everything I thought would happen, it did happen, except for they've been even better than that. And so it's gone from me rolling my eyes at the Royals saying that, oh, we're seven games under, but we just got Duffy back, to me going, well, they're three games over and they just got Duffy back. So I don't see why they can't make a run with this unit. And I think it's just it's pretty crazy how much a difference a month makes.
Well, for me, I like my tone, and I think I've made my thoughts pretty clear, especially with you, that I think every time we've talked, I've said, I think they should be sellers. I think they should be sellers because you're chasing a pipe dream at this point. But I think it's not that I'm changing my tone. It's that they've given me no other option. Like, at this juncture in the season, three games over 500, and you're about a week away from the All-Star break, less than a month away from the trade deadline, like, it's kind of hard to have the opinion at this point that they should still be sellers. Like, the facts just don't agree with you on it.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're in a playoff spot at this point. They're tied for the second wild card, which, you know, I imagine that if that continues, we'll have a lot of conversations about, well, is the second wild card, is a one-game road playoff game worth, quote, mortgaging the future for, which I don't think they'd be mortgaging the future unless they trade off all their farm system to get there. But, you know, they're over 500 in a mediocre division, in a mediocre league, with 79 games to play, and they're in a playoff spot. So you're right. I don't know how you can argue that they should sell. If you can predict the future, you could argue that, I guess. But if they have a shot to make the playoffs, I don't know why you would sell, because I look at it this way. Well, there's a couple things like I really, but when you sell, it's to build your farm system, to create a team that you hope can be competitive for multiple seasons in looking at a playoff spot. The Royals from 2013 to now 2017 have been in playoff contention for five straight years. That's what you hope for. That's what you try to build a team for. Obviously, we know what's happened. They've won a World Series. They went to another, all that. But so you're going to trade these guys for not great value, mind you, because it's 2 months of their time, with the hopes of rebuilding what they've got here. For my money, I would go ahead and see what they can do this season, let them walk for draft picks, which with the qualifying offer, they will have a draft pool that will be in the top five, which allows them to do a lot of cool things in the draft to be able to rebuild the farm system after the season. I would go for it one more time. At this point, I don't think they've left any. I don't think they're left with any other choice, and I don't really understand the argument from the other side saying they should be selling at this point. Even considering their record and their place in the standings.
We're talking to David Leske of Baseball Prospectus Kansas City here on the new FM 101.7, 1320 KLWN. Are they to the point where they could potentially be buyers at the trade deadline if things continue to go the way they have been?
I think so. I don't know what they'll be giving up to buy, and so that's where the calculus is a little bit confusing, because they don't have a ton of high-end prospects, but they can go out and they don't have a lot of holes to fill, which is kind of weird to say for a team that started 10-20, but they're pretty well set all around the diamond. You could talk about, okay, maybe they need a DH, and I'd buy that. They could use some more starting pitching. I saw that Nick Cafardo, who has yet to be right on a Royals rumor, said they're looking at front-end starting rotation help. So, maybe they're doing that. But, a guy like Dan Straley, a reunion with Edinson Volquez, I had a couple other names in my head that have just popped out, Julie Chassin, some people like those guys who can give you six innings every fifth day, that would be nice to have, so you're not relying on Travis Wood and the AAA arms. But that a fourth outfielder, another middle reliever, they don't have a ton of holes to fill, and I think they could get it done. I don't think you're going to see a huge splash, because I don't know what they're going to give up to make a huge splash, but I think they'll improve the team, and I don't think they will be selling off any of their parts.
Who is the most likely candidate amongst the soon-to-be free agents on this team to have a contract extension signed during this season?
Oh, during the season? Vargas, I guess. I don't think any of them are especially likely at this point. I mean, when you get this close to free agency, you're probably not going to forego it. Kane's going to want to see what's out there. Moose is going to want to see what's out there. Hosmer's definitely going to. I guess maybe Escobar would be the answer too, because if they do trade Mondesi or something like that, then I could see them give Escobar another add on a year for $5 million or something like that, which is, by the way, wrong. Don't do that, please, Royals. I don't know that any of them really. I think that really any of them could be back next season, but I don't think any of them are back. I don't think we know they're back until they've hit free agency and haven't found what they want out there.
I mean, who at this point, we've kind of maintained all along that Moose seemed like at least somewhat of a likely candidate to be able to re-sign, simply because his asking price wasn't going to be as high as a guy like Eric Hosmer. But the way he keeps playing, 24 home runs on the season now, third in Major League Baseball, probably on the cusp of his second All-Star appearance in 3 years. I mean, how much is his price tag going up as the weeks go by?
Oh, you can just hear the cash register signs like Vegas when you hear the slot machines. Every swing he takes and the ball ends up 412 feet away, it goes up and up and up and up. And, I don't know what he can expect to get, but I haven't looked too deep into it. But would it surprise anybody if somebody gives him 6 years and $120 million? I mean, the way he's hit this season, and now he's shown, even though it was injury shortened in 2016, he's shown for three straight seasons that he's a different hitter than he was when he was a bad hitter. And he's a solid defender at third. The physical condition, I think, is a little bit concerning. And so maybe that limits him to 4 or 5 years instead of 6 or 7. But the way the guy's hit home runs and the way he's shown that he's a He's a solid offensive contributor for the last three seasons. I don't know what he's going to get, but it's going to be more than I thought it would have been, I don't know, say 3 months ago.
Is he playing himself out of the Royals' price range?
Maybe. I think that as a Boris client and a guy who seems to really want to hit free agency, I think he was always going to look for the best available deal, which I think was never likely to be the Royals unless he signed an extension before the season. So I don't know that he's necessarily playing his way out, but the 5% chance that he came back could be 3.5% now, something like that. I think that the money's just gone up, and he's hit so well that at some point, he's just not going to be able to afford him in Kansas City, which is okay, and that's kind of the way it works. But we'll see. It's hard to say right now because you just don't know who. The Yankees could be in the market for a third baseman next season or in the off season, even though Chase Headley signed next year. But maybe they make a trade for somebody who's controlled for four seasons and they don't need anybody anymore. So it's hard to say for certain exactly how that's going to work out. But I think the odds of Moustakas being in Kansas City next year, if he hits free agency, are getting slimmer and slimmer.
He's David Leske. You can check out all of his work at bpkansascity.com. That's Baseball Prospectus Kansas City. Thanks again for the time, man.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
That is David Leske. I'm Nick Schwartz. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. It's kind of the price you pay, right? It's damned if you do, damned if you don't. If Mike Moustakas doesn't play the way he's playing, then you're kind of telling yourself, okay, well, maybe they have a realistic chance of re-signing him. But you're not as happy about the re-signing because he's not playing well. Conversely, if he's playing like that, playing poorly, then you don't feel good about the team at all. They're probably not winning at the rate in which they've been winning. Now, if he plays well and plays out of his contract, okay, the Royals are winning. He's going to the All-Star game. He's going to participate in the Home Run Derby, but he's playing himself out of your team's price range. So there's good and bad with both scenarios, but I think given the circumstances, given the juncture of where this franchise and organization is, as David just mentioned, being in playoff contention for 5 years now, that's probably a trade-off that you're willing to live with.
I wonder, all things considered, though, like, let's say with as good as Moustakas has been playing, let's say that him and Hosmer were to get pretty similar, at least money per year. I would imagine the years would be longer for Hosmer, but let's say that the money made per year is pretty similar, if not the same, for Moustakas and Hosmer. This might be an unpopular opinion, but I think you might be better off actually going for Hosmer if that scenario is right. Just because, yeah, Moose is having, I would argue, the better year, but are we so sure that, because with Moustakas, he's had solid years, but for Hosmer, yeah, he still hasn't developed into like a guy that we've hoped to be like one of the best players in baseball, but he's still an all-star caliber player, and he's done that over a longer basis. Whereas with Moustakas, it's kind of that question, is this just like a contract year
thing? Well, let me simplify it for you. It's a basic question of who do you have more faith in over the next, 5 years?
Yeah, and I think I would go Hosmer, even though that might be unpopular right now.
Well, I think it's easier to have that conversation if Moose wasn't sidelined the entirety of last year. Because now, all of a sudden, the last 2 years of baseball that you've seen from Mike Moustakas have been really, really good. And I wonder if he would have done something similar to what he's doing this year or something similar to what he did in 2015 last year, as opposed to spending all year on the DL, then what would we be saying? If he had three consecutive years of all-star caliber baseball under his belt, I don't think there'd be a question. I think it'd be clearly you go with Mike Moustakas, because not only is he consistent, but he's one of the best power hitters that you've seen on this team ever. 24 home runs at the All-Star break. Like, he's going to break Balboni's record. It's going to happen. Hopefully I didn't just jinx it, but I think that if you had that under your belt, it'd be a no-brainer. Like, clearly you'd take Mike Moustakas when you add in the fact that he's probably going to be cheaper. But then again, if he's playing like that for 3 years, what would the price tag be at then? Because then all of a sudden, maybe he's not commanding Eric Hosmer money, but maybe it's close enough to the point where you would give the edge to Hosmer. I bet you there are a lot of people right now who would give the edge to Mike Moustakas, even if the money was the same. Because I feel like Eric Hosmer's going to be overpaid in a way that Mike Moustakas won't be.
But who knows? People fall in love with power.
They do, but I just think Hosmer's got so many things going for him, being a name brand guy, being the type of guy you can kind of place at the center of your organization and have him be the face of your franchise. I can't see Moose ever being that guy. Maybe it's because he never has been. Maybe he could be, and we just don't know it yet. 342 on Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
We got your 4:30 news break coming up, well, at 4:30. We'll talk a little bit more Royals coming up at a quarter till 5. The latest on the Chiefs' search for a GM and really why they got into this position in the first place at 5 o'clock. I'm Nick Schwert with Derek Johnson. You're listening to Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Happy to have you with us today, and I'm happy to have you with us right now because it's time for another edition of the most self-explanatory segment in the history of Sports Talk Radio. It is time for Let's Rank Stuff. And Derek, today may just be the most daring, the most controversial, the most polarizing edition of this segment that we've ever done. And I think I may have said that just one time before, but this time I really mean it with all my heart. I don't know if you saw this, but there were I saw four different animal attack videos that went viral this week. And there was one of this guy being chased off a golf course by a moose. There was another one of this family being chased out of a zoo by monkeys, by little spider monkeys that were ganging up on them. And it kind of got me thinking, what's the last animal I ever want to come face to face with, winner take all type of battle? And there aren't very many that I feel great about. In doing this exercise, I found that there are very few animals that I feel like I could hold my own with in the wild. So on today's edition of Let's Rank Stuff, we will be ranking the 10 animals that I'd least want to get into a fight with in the wild. Now, we probably need to set up some ground rules for this because if you throw in the criteria of, oh, this animal definitely wants to fight you, not just maybe it'll fight you, maybe it'll run off. If it definitely wants to fight you, I feel like they'd pretty much all kill me. So can we make the disclaimer? Let's be honest. Even if they didn't, it doesn't really change the
fact. I see what you're saying. So, for instance, an elephant would be something that if you had to fight an elephant, that's ridiculous. You're not going to beat an elephant.
Right.
But I don't think an elephant, in most cases, is going to want to go out of its way to fight you.
I've heard stories, man. Elephants can be very vindictive creatures.
They actually kill some of the most people of any animal in the world, but most of them are by accident. They'll sit on someone.
Yeah. Okay, well, then we'll just kind of keep the criteria pretty loose here, and we'll change it from animal to animal to best suit our needs. Let's start with number 10. It's the one that I brought up. It's one that not very many people would think of in terms of animals you wouldn't want to fight. How about a moose? Is that a moose?
Yeah, it's a moose sound.
Because you don't think of moose as being the type of animal that's the last animal I'd want to see. If a moose wanted to, it could wreck your world, man. They are so tall, 7 feet tall in some instances. If you add their antlers, they're close to 10 feet tall. They're essentially like horses with the biggest rack of antlers on the planet, on top of their head. Incredibly dangerous. They're pretty territorial, I've heard, and they could stomp you. They could beat you with the antlers. If a moose wanted you dead, if it's you and that moose, what are you going to do? I would like to add the disclaimer for all of these, and for the entirety of this list, that in this scenario, you are able to arm yourself with a weapon, but not a firearm.
Okay.
So you could use a spear or a baseball bat.
A sword?
If you wanted to. How often are you going to be caught in the wilderness? You happen to bring your sword along, though, you know? I imagine being stranded and you have to craft your own weaponry. But if you want to throw swords in there, I'll let you have it. Moose is number 10. Number 9. People actually come face to face with these animals in high volume every year, the bull. So with bulls, I don't know why this is an animal that so many people like to not, I mean, they, people fight them. There's a profession. It's the only animal, only animal I know that has created a profession of humans who their sole job is just to fight these animals.
They don't really fight them, though. They more so avoid them.
Hey, they're called bullfighters. I'm going to respect the craft. I'm going to respect that profession. But yeah, bull wants you dead, stomp on you. It would be incredibly painful if it wanted to, what's it called? If they gore you with their horn. That'd hurt pretty bad.
Yeah, just imagine if the horn got, like, stuck on you and they're bucking you around.
And maybe one of the meanest animals out there. How many creatures just get angry at a color? You know what I mean? You've got to be, you got to be a pretty mean, wretched animal to just get angry at it, at just seeing a type of color. So the bull is number 9. And number 8 is going to be an animal that people are going to wonder, how do you not have this higher on the list? This is where the controversy begins, is the bear. Bears of all varieties. Black bears, grizzly bears, polar bears. They're all scary. But the reason why I have bears so low on the list is that I feel like bears aren't super smart. Is that
the man or beast that I run from ain't been born, and its mama's already dead.
That's the guy who who fought a bear. Like, there are stories of guys who have fought bears off. You can kind of scare them into thinking that you're bigger than you actually are. They say if you come across a bear, to raise your arms up and make the bear think that you're bigger than you actually are. Like, if that's all it takes to make a bear think you're big is by raising your arms.
But hold on. Isn't the whole premise of this you're actually in a fight with them?
I think I could get
so
the bear.
You can't use that tactic. You can't use the play dead tactic. Like, you're actually fighting them.
If I use that criteria as they want to fight me no matter what, then I'm going to lose every one of these. If they're not ever going to run away. If they're going to stay there until they defeat me, then they're going to win every time.
Okay.
Are there any animal I've named that you think that I would be able to hold my own with? Like, if I had a spear.
No.
If I had a spear against a bear, it would snap that thing in half instantly. And then, I don't know, crush my skull. But that's why I have the bear's height. Is even if the bear was dead set on attacking me, I feel like it'd be over pretty quick. Like, it'd be pretty quick and painless. It'd crush your skull.
I don't know about painless. I think that thing would throw you around.
Hopefully. Maybe you'd go straight for the jugular and just end it quickly.
I don't think bears do that.
That's what I'd hope. It's 412 on Rock Chalk Sports Talk. It's Let's Rank Stuff. Animals I'd least want to fight. Number 7. Again, people are going to wonder, how is this so low? The lion.
But you know, I had to go in the jungle to kill the lions.
If
JoJo did it.
If Joel Embiid can kill a lion, then I can kill a lion. I mean, there are kids in Africa who have coming-of-age moments where they just go out into the wild and kill a lion. They don't come back until they kill a lion. Children can do it, albeit trained children. I feel like I could figure out a way.
Okay.
And lions, despite what may be said about lions, they're not super aggressive towards humans the way that perhaps tigers may be.
So, are you grouping together lions and tigers?
I'm not. Okay. Tigers did not make the cut. Spoiler alert. Lions at number 7.
Told.
Gosh dang it, tiger! Number 6. We're going to go to the wolf. Now, wolves in a pack would be unbelievably scary. Mm-hmm. But even just one wolf, I don't like the way their eyes look. Again, there's something that would be incredibly painful to fight. I feel like that would be a slow death. They just kind of gnaw at you and rip away several parts. You're looking for animals that are just going to, if they're going to end you, they're going to do it quickly. They're going to go straight for the throat, go for the throat rip, you're out. You're done, right? I'd imagine you're not feeling much after that.
No, and I don't think people realize how big wolves are. Like, there was that big debate when Arian Foster said he could take a wolf. Like, they're not the size
huge.
Of dogs. They're not the size of coyotes. Like, these things
they're
are
like 3 feet tall, and they're like 6 feet long.
I think they're bigger than that.
I mean, that's pretty big.
I know, and they're even bigger than that.
Incredibly strong jaws. They're smart animals. You can't really scare them away.
They literally have, like, this ability to sense where your blood is and can know where your jugular is.
Yeah. They have, like, thermal technology inside
their
brain.
Bite is strong enough to break your bone.
The only thing that humans have going for them against any animal in the wild, they have two things, right? Intelligence, ability to, like, rationalize and, like, figure out exit strategies. and opposable thumbs. That's pretty much all you have going for you if you're pitted against one of these animals in the wild. The question you have to ask yourself is, how are you going to use your advantages to your ability? Because you know that animal is going to use all of their various animals to their ability. Their size, the density of their bones, their strength, the hunting capabilities. What are you going to do? What are you bringing to the table? We're into the top five on Let's Rank Stuff, animals I'd least want to fight. New FM 101.7, 1320 KLWN. Number five, the crocodile.
Boy, there's a king croc right there. He must be 4 meters, 12, 13 feet long at least.
The problem with the crocodile is that I don't feel like any weapon that I would have armed myself with would do me much against a crocodile.
Yeah, your spear is not doing anything on those scales.
I feel like those scales are pretty tough. Going to be pretty tough to pierce those. Crocodiles versus alligators. Alligators are, I guess, predispositioned to be afraid of humans, whereas crocodiles are not. They're the ones with the pointed snouts. They'll come right at you. That would be a long and painful death. That would be very long because they don't have arms to kind of rip you apart with. Like, I feel like the crocodile would just be death by a million bites, and they'd all be very, very painful.
I actually read a story that sometimes crocodiles will, like, kill you pretty much, take you back to a den, or not even fully kill you, just kind of get you to a point where, like, you can't do anything, bring you back to your den and let you kind of, like, soften up and bleed out a bit, and then they'll finally finish you off. That's a long death.
Yeah, and especially if there's multiple of them, they're kind of ripping you apart, man. That wouldn't be very fun. So the crocodile at number five, I just gave it away. Number four, the hippopotamus. Doesn't get much respect as being a dangerous animal. I think of a favorite animal amongst children. You see, like, plush little cute hippos. Hungry, hungry hippos. We play that game. Lovable animals. Not true. Disgusting, vile, angry, vindictive animals.
They actually are up there as well as one of the animals that kill a ton of people in Africa. Like, I mean, you're talking, they can go like
super,
30 miles per hour, super aggressive.
Super aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Those big teeth around you.
I used to think, like, rhinos were the boss hogs of, like, the Serengeti in Africa. It's not. The safari, it's the hippo. The most dangerous animal in the safari. Amongst all the types of snakes they've got out there, all the different wild cats, yeah. The hippos are the ones you got to be most afraid of because they will charge you, and if they do, you're done. You're done. Into the top three animals I'd least want to fight on Let's Rank Stuff, Rock Chalk Sports Talk. Number three, the boa constrictor, or really, really any type of snake. Anacondas, vipers, cobras, any of that stuff. I want nothing
to do with
it.
Just counting every snake.
Well, what are you going to do against a snake? Because you're not going to be able to hit
right.
It with your spear. It's just going to eventually kill you. But the reason I put boa constrictors is, like, if a snake bites you, that would suck. Like, if a cobra or a rattlesnake bites you. But once it bites you, I mean, you're going to die.
It's showing its cards, yeah.
It's not, like, a smaller snake is not going to eat you.
Right.
So it's like it's just going to bite you and run away. Like, it's done. It's killed you. Boa constrictor, gonna wrap you up, gonna crush your bones, and then when it's done with that, it's gonna, like, eat you whole.
Yum. That'd be fun.
And those things are just imposing to see. Like, if you see a boa constrictor, you're like, ah, what do I do now?
Yeah.
How fast do snakes go? I feel like I could outrun a snake, though. Right?
I would think so.
I don't know if I could outrun any of these other animals. I think I could outrun a crocodile. But you're not outrunning.
Yeah, boa constrictors only go 1 mile per hour. So, I mean, you can outrun it.
All right, well, maybe this doesn't deserve to be so high on the list.
Maybe
but
not.
The list is finalized, and that's all there is to it. Number two, the great white shark. So now we're getting into aquatic territory, which, you know my feelings about water in general. Don't like it. Don't like fresh bodies of water because you never know what's lurking beneath. And that would be the worst part about fighting a shark, is you're out of your element. First off, you can't see anything. I mean, unless you're scuba diving, which would probably be one of the main ways to encounter a shark. But if you don't have goggles, then it's by far the worst, because it's just attacking you, ripping your legs off, and you can't see it.
And possibly drowning you at
the
same time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, definitely drowning you at the same time. That might deserve to be number one, but you'll see why it's not, because number one, Let's Rank Stuff, animals I'd least want to fight. I've stated it several times before. I'm not backing off it now. The gorilla. Because remember those advantages I spoke of? The advantages that humans have over animals in the wild? Intelligence and opposable thumbs? Oh, gorilla is one of the smartest animals? Okay. Oh, gorillas have opposable thumbs? Where are your advantages? They're all gone. A human being has absolutely zero advantages over the gorilla other than, I mean, yeah, you've got significantly more intelligence, but like being able to do calculus or being able to like read a weather map, that's not going to help you against a gorilla. Like the types of intelligence that you need in the wild aren't really advantages anymore. So what advantages do you have over a gorilla? I feel like the death would be unbelievably painful because they're not just going to like go for your jugular the way that other animals are. They're going to rip you apart. Mm. They're going to crush you. They're going to beat you up, man. It's going to be like the worst butt whooping you've ever received in your life.
Again, as I was doing prep for this, I just love reading some of these animal stories. I don't know why I subject myself to this, but I guess there was a story, a gorilla once literally ripped out the limbs of a person and started hitting the person with them.
That's just adding insult to injury, right? Is it not?
Literally.
Like, you ever heard like a movie or some guy's like trying to talk smack to you and he says, like, I'm going to rip your arm off and beat you with it.
Mm-hmm.
The gorillas literally do that.
All right. I have a contest with this. Now, do you know what the Cape buffalo is? They say this is the most, I guess, not necessarily the dangerous, but it's the most unforgiving animal in Africa. It's one of the, you know, the African big
rounded,
five.
They have the big rounded horns, right?
Yes. And so basically this thing, it holds grudges. Like there's stories of somebody will come up on a Cape buffalo and do it wrong by taking a picture or something that it doesn't like. 2 years later, they'll come up and the Cape buffalo will know the person.
No.
These things will chase people up trees. They'll wait.
They can't climb
trees. 3 or 4 days. There are cases. They can't climb the tree. There are cases where the Cape buffalo will starve itself to death before the person comes down. They'll pee on their tail and flick it up to make the person itch.
Wow.
So that they fall off. And these things will gorge you with the horn. They kill lions in Africa. The lions are afraid of them.
I feel like I kind of already gave the Cape buffalo credence by putting bull at number 9. Mm. Can we just lump Cape buffalo?
I think they should be ahead of lions. They kill the lions.
Well, the list is finalized, and that's all there is to it. That's Let's Rank Stuff. Glad we got through it. Certainly was as daring as promised. It's Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Your 4:30 news break coming up next.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
It's 4:25, Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Derek Johnson in studio with me. I'm Nick Schwert. Happy to have you with us on a lovely Wednesday afternoon. Hope your light beer and gunpowder hangover is starting to wear off as you realize you're barely halfway done with the week. Well, actually, you're over halfway done. Most people on their way home at this point. It's time for your 4:30 news break, Derek, and we start... Well, right down the road in Malaysia, as a man
next door neighbors
by the name of Joe Low,
great name,
is essentially the adverse of Robin Hood. Robin Hood famously stole from the rich to give to the poor. Well, Joe Low is the man at the center of a $6 billion theft from a Malaysian charity fund that was created to help poor people in Malaysia. So he was essentially the mastermind behind this fund. It was a wealth fund that was started to pay for infrastructure and housing and development projects in Malaysia, while the banks that backed it netted a ton of money, billions of dollars. Well, instead of taking that money and building the infrastructure, this guy was laundering the money into his personal accounts and using it to do what people with billions of dollars do, which is whatever the hell you want. He used it to hobnob with celebrities. Are you familiar with the supermodel Miranda Kerr?
Steve Kerr's daughter? I don't know.
No. She
worth a shot.
Was married to Orlando Bloom, the actor from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Has he been in anything since then?
He's in the Lord of the Rings stuff. I don't know what else he's done. But now she's married to Evan Spiegel, who founded Snapchat. So this guy, JoLo, right after she divorced Orlando Bloom, bought her $8 million worth of jewelry, which she has since had to return to the authorities who are trying to get all of this money from investors who lost, you know, billions of dollars. Where'd all this money go? Oh, Miranda Kerr has $8 million worth of jewelry. Let's go get that back from her. She gave it back. But just a little quick tidbit on Miranda Kerr. She went from Orlando Bloom, actor, to random Malaysian billionaire to other billionaire who founded Snapchat.
She'll be okay.
Of course she's going to be okay. I'm saying maybe a little bit of an insight onto who Miranda Kerr is as a person.
And saying she a gold digger.
I'm just saying she has a thing for billionaires. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's not the only way he spent his money. He was at a New York City nightclub. And after the club shut down, he paid for 8 of the waitresses to come to an after party with him in Malaysia. They hopped on his private jet and flew to Malaysia for an after party. Like, what would it take for you? And you're a guy, so it would literally never happen. But like, if you're an attractive woman and you're hanging out at a bar and he's like, hey, you want to come to my after party on the other side of the world? We get on a plane right now. Would you do it?
No.
He's like, I got a private jet.
What happens after the after party? The after party?
I mean, clearly.
He's kind of sitting there in Malaysia. Like, how do I get home?
Yeah.
I don't have my passport.
I would assume he'd fly you back. He spent hundreds of million of dollars on rare art pieces. He is widely thought to be the person who bought Picasso's Women of Algiers last May for $141 million at an auction, which is the most expensive painting ever purchased. He bought two apartments in New York City, one at the building where P. Diddy lives for $30 million, another condo in New York City for $24 million. So he's living this lavish lifestyle. Word gets out. And he begins to donate tons of money to charity, over $200 million. The only catch is that all of these charities, or most of them, are affiliated with A-list celebrities.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm looking at a picture of this guy, and like, what you're saying about Miranda Kerr with the billionaires, it's becoming a little bit more clear now.
It doesn't just happen to be, oh, he's attractive and he's a billionaire. Yeah. It's like,
at least the other two guys.
He's a chubby Malaysian man who found billions of dollars to spend however he chose. So his buddy starts this movie company called Red Granite. He donates $100 million to this company. First project they did, a little movie, you may have heard of it, The Wolf of Wall Street. He was at the premiere with Leonardo DiCaprio. He and Leonardo DiCaprio have traveled the world together. He donates millions of dollars to his charity. He donates millions of dollars to Alicia Keys' charity. He gives $50 million to the University of Texas Cancer Center. He donates $20 million to Panthera, which is a group that protects like wild cats, like endangered wild cats. $3 million to the United Nations Foundation. So now authorities are trying to get all this money back, but he's donated it all to charity. And these charities have already allocated the money that you do when you get money for a charity. You go and you spend it on the things that you spend it on. Which brings up an ethical dilemma. Because he stole from a lot of people. He stole a lot of money from a lot of people. And he spent a lot of it pretty frivolously. But he also donated to charity. So where do we come out on this guy? Is he a terrible guy who just happened to do a couple good things? Or should we have more people like him?
So is he a good guy that did some bad things or a bad guy that did some good things?
That's what we want to answer. So he's like a version of Robin Hood, but instead of stealing from the rich and giving to the poor, he steals from the rich who were going to give to the poor, and then takes that money and gives it to the rich, but sometimes he's stealing from the poor so that he can give to the rich, who will then give it to the poor, or maybe endangered wild animals. I say we call it a wash. I say, you know, he did a lot of terrible things, but he did a few good things along the way. I mean, he could donate $50 million to cancer research.
Yeah, but he also spent, what was it, $30 million? He spent more than that on two apartments.
Yeah, and he also spent $141 million on a painting.
I say the money stays with the charities, but the rest of the money, like, he owes back.
Let's bring it over to America. How about Fox Sports fired their president, Jamie Horowitz, over the weekend amid a sexual harassment probe? Now, no one spoke specifically about what was going on, but this comes on the heels of Fox Sports laying off all of their digital writers, which is all their writers. And if you go to their website right now, it's all videos. When ESPN had those layoffs earlier in the year, Fox Sports was the place to go for commentary. Like, okay, so here's the background on Horowitz. His break came when he took over First Take on ESPN back in 2011. He noted that the First and 10 debate shows with Skip Bayless and Stephen A. Smith were more popular than people just talking about stuff. So Horowitz just cut the news and interviews, and he doubled down on the debate format, which he would perform again and again and again at ESPN, then over on Fox Sports. So then he goes to Fox Sports. He brings Skip Bayless with him, gives him $25 million to come to Fox Sports with him. Then after that, he grabs Colin Cowherd. And all of a sudden, you think, oh, wow, a power play by Fox Sports poaching some of ESPN's most polarizing talent. What are they going to do with it? And the answer is nothing. Because Fox became a pulpit for two things: debate-centric shows and talking about how bad ESPN's doing. ESPN had the layoffs. Fox Sports was talking about them every single day. Cowherd was doing his show, and he's making these videos talking about the nuances of the ever-changing sports media landscape and how ESPN had failed to adapt with the times, and that's why their ratings were struggling and people were cutting cords. It's all ESPN's fault. All right, ESPN's doing all these things wrong, and Fox Sports is going to tell you about it. The problem was that Cowherd was doing all of this on a show and a network that nobody is or was consuming. Like, the ratings on Fox Sports are abysmal. Nobody watches it. Even though they want to tell you all the things that ESPN's doing wrong and why no one's watching ESPN, ESPN is crushing Fox Sports in the ratings. Like, absolutely blows them out of the water. And it's not even close. So then last week, Horowitz laid off all of FoxSports.com's online writers and its exclusive video content. That's all they have on their website. If you go to their website right now, the top videos are going to be Skip Bayless talking about Gordon Hayward going to Boston and Colin Cowherd talking about David Price. There's a video on the front page right now of Charlie Weiss and Skip Bayless talking about Tom Brady. Charlie Weiss in studio on Fox Sports. Like, that's what they're doing now. Like, these are the way that they're changing the sports media landscape, is by bringing on Charlie Weiss, watching him just plop into a chair and talk about the greatness of Tom Brady. Like, that's what's going to get ratings up? Like, that's how you're changing the sports media landscape, is by bringing on the biggest, literally the biggest curmudgeon in the history of sports, Charlie Weiss. I mean, if that's the future of sports media, then I feel like we missed an opportunity.
Have you looked at that pile of crap out there?
I feel like we had some inroads to Charlie Weiss that we didn't necessarily take advantage of. All right.
You know, we're not, you know,
Derek, you're the guy I go to when I need to find somebody who's never heard of something, because you've, like, never heard of anything, never right. seen anything. Do you know what NPR is?
Yes, I know what NPR is.
Okay. One for one. Let me see.
Are you trying to stump me?
Tell me.
Can't be that hard.
Tell me what notable piece of literature or history this is from.
Okay.
Just a random excerpt, okay? It is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government. What is that from?
I would guess that is either from...
No, you don't get to hedge your bet.
Okay. We'll go with the Declaration of Independence. My other guess was... Oh.
Correct.
Other guess was going to be Emancipation Proclamation.
You know what that makes you...
I'm glad I didn't do that.
That makes you a great American for being able to just see or hear a random excerpt and know that it's from the Declaration of Independence. Well, every single year on 4th of July, the NPR Twitter account in... you know, short bursts, tweets out the entirety of the Declaration of Independence. Apparently, it's something they've done every year since they started a Twitter account. And they did the same thing yesterday. And so they go through and they're starting it just line by line, just reading off the Declaration of Independence. And people started going nuts. People who apparently didn't know it was the Declaration of Independence... Judging by this tweet of the one I just read to you, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute the new government. That's a line from the Declaration of Independence. And one guy, D.G. Davies, says, so, NPR is calling for revolution. Interesting way to condone the violence while trying to sound patriotic. Your implications are clear. Another person responds, propaganda, is that all you know? Try supporting a man who wants to do something about the injustice in the country. Please stop. This is not the right place. Clearly, the NPR journalists with a mission. Mm. So people weren't picking up on the fact that this was actually, you know, a piece of...
steal the Declaration of Independence.
This is the document to which Nicolas Cage spent years trying to acquire.
Still is.
Is he still going after it?
Yeah, that's why you haven't seen him in many movies.
Well, most of these guys come out afterwards. People are responding saying, dude, it's the Declaration of Independence. Like, stop freaking out, you moron. And some of these people came out and tried to apologize. But that's the worst part. Is like, if you say something that idiotic, like if you're calling out somebody for just tweeting, like, words of the Declaration of Independence and you're saying, really, like, propaganda, you fools. Like, if you're doing that, you can never, ever come back from it. Because Twitter is not a place where you can, you know, put your mistakes in the past. Twitter is not a place where apologies are welcome. This guy comes out and apologizes, and people just still hammering him for it, saying, you're a moron, you're an idiot, you never should have mistaken it in the first place, you're not a true American. Like, if you tweet out something so dumb, if you put something so dumb on social media... do you even try apologizing, or do you just live it, take your lumps, move on?
I don't have enough followers to worry about that.
How many followers are you rocking?
3-something. Ooh. Not too many.
You got to get that number up. Maybe more higher volume. Higher volume, more funny, more interesting. Be more interesting. Be less like you and more like, I don't know.
The problem is, like...
me?
Everybody should be like Nick and make a better world. But the problem is, I just like... I go into... I guess tweet comas. I just don't really go on for a little
bit. Got to keep that content up, man. Yeah. You got to keep that volume up. That is your Wednesday news break. It's 4:41 on Rock Chalk Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLW. And let's continue talking about those pesky Royals coming up next.
This is Rock Chalk Sports Talk with Nick Schwert on new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.
It's 5:05 on Rock Chalk Sports Talk, new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. Derek Johnson's in studio with me. I'm Nick Schwert. Happy to have you with us on a lovely Wednesday afternoon. Do you see this? There is a very cheap way to, I guess, purchase season tickets to Chiefs games. It is called the Bud Light Game Day Pass. It is a mobile-only ticket option for fans looking for low-priced seats. So here's how it works. You pay $200. That covers you for the whole season. And you will be guaranteed a ticket to all 10 home games at Arrowhead Stadium, which would include 2 preseason games and then 8 regular season games. Now, the seats will be in the upper level of Arrowhead Stadium. And they're non-transferable. So, like, even if you wanted to buy not just one for you, if you wanted to buy 4, you have to have all of them. But nobody cares about preseason. So if you were just to say, okay, I paid $200 and I've got season tickets to all the home games, you'd be paying $25 a pop. $25 a pop for 8 home games, which is cheaper than pretty much if you just went and tried to buy one single ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Like, go to the worst game of the year, you're still paying $20-$30 just to get tickets. And it doesn't cover parking, obviously. But $200...
doesn't cover ticket fees either.
And because a lot of people want good tickets and want to go to the good games. But, like, if you're somebody who only goes to a couple games a year and you're going to shell out, if you're going to 2 games, you're going to spend $100 on tickets, probably. If you want to go to, like, see the Raiders or if you want to go see the Broncos, you're gonna have to end up shelling $40 a pop at least. I mean, I went to a Raiders game a couple years ago in the upper deck, and it cost close to $80 for one ticket. So to get $200 to get season tickets, isn't that just an unbelievably great deal?
It is a great deal.
And a great idea.
Oh, absolutely. So am I hearing and reading this correctly that basically you won't necessarily, even though it's like a season ticket, it's more of a season pass to where you won't necessarily have the same seat every time?
Right, exactly. What they're essentially doing is like, setting aside a certain number of seats every game. And I would imagine they're going to be really, really, really crappy seats.
Right. But it'll be a situation where they're like, okay, there's not a lot of seats that have been bought in this area, so let's reserve these ones and get these people over here for this game.
Yes, essentially. And it'll probably change game to game as to where those seats will be. But, I mean, if you don't care about where your seats are, which, I mean, I know a lot of people who don't. I generally don't either. I mean, I go to about 1 or 2 Chiefs games a year, and I'm almost always sitting in the upper deck. So I very rarely care about where my seats are. If you just want to get into the game, and even if you don't go to all 8, like, there would probably be a couple games. Like, if you were to buy those games in December, yeah, I'm probably not going to those.
See, but that's the thing. When you buy season tickets, like, I could spend $150, $100 on season tickets. But at that point, like, after you bought the season tickets, I feel like you just kind of feel obligated that you're like, oh, I got to go.
Well, yeah, if you're paying season ticket prices,
right.
You would.
So you wake up
if
Sunday morning.
If you're paying $200 and you've already been to 6 games this year, what do you care?
I don't know. I would still feel obligated. You wake up Sunday morning, it's 20 degrees, and you're kind of like getting out of bed, and you're like, I don't want to do this. It's kind of like a task, but you're going to go because you have season tickets.
Oh, I think I told you the story last year. We did a fantasy draft at Arrowhead Stadium for our fantasy football league, and
there you had a ticket with it, right?
Yeah, there's 12 of us. We got to do our draft in a suite in Arrowhead, and it each came with a ticket to a game to be announced. We didn't know which game it was going to be. Well, it was the Titans game. And we were actually fine with that because, you know, it's the Titans, Marcus Mariota, they got some young players. It'd be a fun game. Well, it's approaching, and all of a sudden, it was like December 18th or something. Happened to be the coldest day of 2016 in Kansas City. And as the day was approaching, I kind of told my friends, like, yo, there's a good chance I'm not going to be there. Woke up, 6:30 a.m., -5 degrees, -18 with the wind chill. Had a high of 10 degrees, which would feel like -2. I go, nope, not going. All my friends are meeting at my place. They all show up, and they're like, yo, we're going, right? They're all bundled up, 18 jackets on. I'm like, I'm not going. And it's been held over my head to this day. I'm the commissioner of the league. There were people who wanted to impeach me. They wanted to fire me as commissioner because I didn't go to that Chiefs game. So, yes, there is, and none of them even contemplated not going. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that none of them had even thought about skipping the game because it was the only game most of them were going to all year. And it's just like, I think it kind of goes. Once you have the ticket, you feel obligated to go, except unless you're me.
Yeah, I think you have a flake gene. That'd be a fair way of putting it.
You think I'm flaky?
I don't know. Maybe not flaky. Flaky maybe more implies that, like, you say you're going to go something to something and you don't. Maybe more of
You
think so?
That's accurate.
Okay. I was going to say kind of weaseling out of things.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And, like, I would say that's probably one of my bigger issues I need to work on personally is I can be a flaky person. Sometimes, hey, if I commit to something, it's not super steadfast. I mean, it gets brought up on the show all the time with the shaving of the head, which I'm still going to do. But yeah.
Beer mile?
Sometimes, yes, we're going to do that too. Sometimes, yeah, I've flaked out on a couple things, but I always come up with a viable excuse.
So here's what we're going to do. We're going to try to make each other better every day. I'll try to make you less flaky. You try to make me
more
just know things.
No,
yeah.
I just want to make you more interesting. I've maintained that there's nothing about you that I don't know. There's no aspect of your life that I couldn't, if not at least hit on the nail of the head, I could probably get pretty close to it. Like, you know, the Dos Equis, the most interesting man in the world. You are like his alter ego, which is like the least interesting man in
which
the world.
Which in a sense makes what it very
see,
interesting.
What you see with Derek is what you get. What you hear with Derek, it's what you get. You're like, oh, like there'll never be a case in my life where I'm like, oh, I didn't know that about you, man. That's whoa, Derek, you went to Nepal as a kid? You lived in Nepal as a kid? Wow.
I actually did.
There's nothing about you. There's nothing about you I think that would just shock me.
I wonder if we could turn this into like a game show.
Workshop it. You're the executive producer. That's why we pay you the big bucks. It's 513 Rock Chalk Sports Talk, New FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN. So Albert Breer is a writer for Peter King's NFL site, the Monday Morning Quarterback. And he posted a piece this morning. It's titled The John Dorsey Dismissal, Where It Went Wrong in Kansas City. And he kind of echoes the sentiments that we've heard everybody from around the league say since John Dorsey's fire, which was that it caught most people off guard. Like, it shocked people in positions of power all over the league because he had seemingly on the surface had a great relationship with his head coach. He had seemed to have had a great relationship with his owner. And that's important because the power structure at One Arrowhead Way is a little bit different than it is with other organizations, and it's different than how it used to be with the Chiefs. When it was Scott Pioli, you had your typical chain of command where Todd Haley reported to Scott Pioli and Scott Pioli reported to Clark Hunt. Well, we know what happened there. There was some bad blood between Pioli and Haley. Things started to kind of fester over. And Hunt, apparently, when all of that went down and he had to fire both of them, didn't want to ever repeat those mistakes of having this stuff going on under his watch, but him not knowing about it. So when he hires John Dorsey and Andy Reid, he changes it up to the point of which they both report directly to him. Andy Reid reports directly to him. John Dorsey reports directly to him. So he knows everything that's going on. And with John Dorsey, right, we knew he and Andy Reid both had their contracts coming up. We thought that they were both going to get resigned because everything seemed to be working pretty smoothly. But Andy Reid gets that fat deal through 2021. John Dorsey gets shown the door. But what went wrong with John Dorsey was essentially he was a bad communicator. Yes, he made some poor decisions. Like, you draft Kevin Hogan in the fifth round and he's gone. He didn't even make the roster. You draft Kavari Russell. And he, what, made the roster but was cut during training camp, I think was the case with him. You sign Eric Fisher to a long-term contract, a really massive deal, $48 million, when he hadn't even really earned the left tackle spot. You've got an Eric Berry deal that you need to get done, and you sign Laurent Duvernay-Tardif to a 5-year, $41 million deal. And it's not as though they didn't want to keep Eric Fisher or Duvernay-Tardif around. It's that you had more pressing issues to take care about while this Eric Berry contract extension is playing out in the media, a guy who Clark Hunt essentially considers to be family and an untouchable player in this organization. You're leaving him high and dry while taking care of guys who still have years left on their contracts. And Dorsey did all of this without consulting, without telling other people, without letting everybody know what the game plan was here. And it's almost like a death by a million paper cuts, right? It's not like signing Duvernay-Tardif was enough to get you fired. It's not like leaving Jeremy Mack on a voicemail, letting him know he'd been cut, is a reason to get fired. It's not like taking a year too long to get Eric Berry's contract extension done is a reason to get fired, or that letting Chris Ballard walk and go to Indianapolis and become their GM is a reason to get fired. But you add all of these things up, and as Clark Hunt, you say, John Dorsey's done a great job. He's made a lot of really good decisions, but he's also made some bad ones, ones that you can live with. But you add them together, you add in the miscommunication. It was just a case of, this guy's great, but we can do better without him. Like, we feel like there's ways to shore up this organization and the way they operate. And again, I understand all of that. I understand from an owner's perspective why you would want things to run as smoothly as possible. And if you think there's room for improvement, then you're going to do that. But where I have the disconnect, and where I've had the disconnect with the way all of this took place, is, couldn't you have survived one more year? Not only couldn't you have survived one more year with John Dorsey at the helm, because, hey, he was still contractually obligated to go through this season. And it sounds like he didn't walk. It sounds like Clark Hunt showed him the door. And yeah, the Jeremy Maclin situation was probably the straw that broke the camel's back. Not only could you have survived with another year of John Dorsey, wouldn't you have been better off? Would you not have been better off with one more year as a GM, a fairly good one, as opposed to making a stand and letting him walk and firing your GM at the end of June?
And it's not even a full year. You just would have had to deal with him for 6-7 months. You're just going through January, hopefully February, if everything works out. Yeah, to me, it just completely, everything points to, and yeah, like you said, there are clues out there that say that, yeah, Dorsey messed this up or messed that up, but none of them were overarching things that normally would get a GM fired. To me, this all stinks of power struggle in the front office, mainly with the president, and it's odd because it's really the first time we've ever seen that with Clark Hunt.
Yeah, and it's not, it's, I don't want to like point the finger directly at Clark Hunt, because at the end of the day, like, you can boil it down any which way you want to, right? If you want to attack this from the scope of, it was just an owner making the best decision for his organization. All right, well, it's an overly simplified way of looking at things, but you wouldn't necessarily be incorrect. Yeah, it's his job to do what's in the best interest of the organization. Clark Hunt did that by letting John Dorsey go. Like, yeah, you can't really argue with that. But you just have to wonder if it wouldn't have just been better to play out the rest of the season and let things end amicably and naturally when his contract was up. And who knows, maybe there was more of an internal struggle than is being released at this point. Like, maybe John Dorsey kind of gave him no choice. Maybe he told him, no, if you're going to resign Andy and not me, then I'm out, which would seem a little ironic for a GM to do that when, like, that's what he does his whole life. He's, like, re-signing other guys while other dudes are waiting. Wait a minute, what about me? That's what Eric Berry was doing. That's what Justin Houston was doing. They were waiting for contract extensions while you signed other guy to big deals. That's what GMs do. And maybe it was a case of John Dorsey getting a taste of his own medicine and not wanting to deal with it. But If this was in any way, shape, or form John Dorsey's decision, then you'd be implying that John Dorsey said, I'd rather be unemployed this year than work for you for another year. And I have a really hard time believing that's what happened. Like, it's hard for me to fathom that John Dorsey said, well, if you don't extend me at the same time you extend Andy, then I'm gone. Then I'm walking. And the way it all played out, it doesn't seem like that's what happened. It seems like this was Clark Hunt showing John Dorsey the door. And if that's the truth, we keep going back to it, if that's actually what happened, save everything else. If this was a case of Clark Hunt saying, John, see you later, then that to me is unforgivable. Not to say that John Dorsey should have spent the rest of his life here, but you just can't convince me that they wouldn't have been better off with a GM than without one. And yes, they will hit the season, they will have somebody. Whether it's the Brett Veach guy that Andy brought with him from Philly, an outside hire from Buffalo or Tennessee or any of these places where we've heard guys being rumored to the job, whatever. They're going to have somebody. It'll be somebody that 99% of the common fans won't have ever heard of. And then we'll hear all these stories about how good of a guy he is and all the success he's had. And everybody will get excited and we'll say, they're better off. This guy's better than Dorsey. But this just, on the surface, seems like something you'd rather not be dealing with. So the piece is on MMQB.com. It's by Albert Breer. Kind of breaks down the whole John Dorsey situation. It's pretty interesting. Not anything really groundbreaking, but once you hear more and more guys talking about how shocked they were shocked. They couldn't believe this happened. And you hear the anonymous people who work within the organization, most of which enjoyed working alongside or for John Dorsey. It makes this one even more of a head-scratcher. It's 522 Rock Chuck Sports Talk on the new FM 101.7 and 1320 KLWN.